Hey, we are excited about a new manufacturer. They're not a new manufacturer,
no,
Don, but they're a major manufacturer that is getting into the trail running scene, and they're doing it in a very big way. One of those ways is they have Topher Gaylord, who has been with the North Face Group, with Montrail and Mountain Hardware, and now he's with Under Armour.
You know, if you want to do something big, you look back into the history of what people have done, and you bring them along to help move your brand forward, and Topher is the guy to do it. If you've been around the sport any amount of time, you've seen him. And let me tell you, Scott, where I first became aware of Topher, and I've shared this with you before, Topher, but I have a feeling that the people are listening weren't standing around our conversation. And that is when I was watching Race for the Soul, that movie about Western States, and I saw Topher on there, and he was explaining the race and the enthusiasm he had. And I said, you know what? I want part of that. I want to get some of what he's talking about. So, Topher, know it or not, you've been one of my mentors and some of the one of the people that helped pull me into this sport.
Right on, you guys. Hey, thanks for having me on, and thanks for the words. It's always humbling to speak about the ultra running community, and the sport just has, and the trail running community just has so much passion and genuine authenticity to it. And you know, the coolest thing about about trail running is just the relationships that are born, and I think that's part of that's through kind of the shared experiences of the mountains, and then the shared experiences of kind of pushing beyond what you think your capabilities are. So awesome to be on with you guys, and psyched to share some thoughts with you.
Hey, so what are you doing with Under Armour? They picked you up, and what task did they provide for you to complete?
Yeah, it's cool. You know, as you'd mentioned, I've worked with a lot of different brands. You know, 17 years with the North Face, and another six working in leading the Mountain Hardware and Montrail brands. And then I got to know the guys here at Under Armour. I took a year break after kind of being in race pace in my working career, and I was doing a nice job of balancing that with my professional life, but I always had these big goals to go do some big mountain runs and expeditions in the Himalaya. And so we took some time off and ran around the Khumbu region, the Everest region in the Himalaya, and it was just a tremendous adventure, my wife and I, Kim. And then I came back and I got to know the Under Armour folks, and it's an incredible brand, a really energizing, fast-growing brand, and they were really looking to build their foundation in the outdoor community. And I thought, what a great opportunity to come in and open up the outdoor community to the brand. They had a very strong presence in kind of fishing and hunting area, and an emerging and growing presence in what I would consider more the active outdoor sports. And so I'm helping them unlock trail running and in the running categories. I'm the general manager of outdoor and running for Under Armour today.
Sweet.
I'd like to be a general manager for outdoor.
You're the general manager around here, Scott. You're okay. You've got the same title as Topher. I mean,
maybe I should have some cards made up just for fun.
We'll get on it. Hey, so there's a mountain running series that's going on with Under Armour. Tell us a little bit about that and the distances, because that's what I was enticed. They're distances for all trail runners, it looks like.
Yeah, cool. I mean, you know, we kind of incubated this idea, you know, in trail running right now, it's just such an energizing way and I really believe it's trail running is kind of that confluence, that perfect confluence between the outdoor kind of mountain athletes and community and the purebred running community. And it's a really cool tribe that's kind of mixing up between pure runners and authentic mountain athletes. And the thing is, and there's so much demand and appetite to access trail races, but most trail races today they're basically ultra distance. I mean, a lot of them. And there were very few race formats that had really kind of shorter accessible formats. And so we came up with this concept to have a three race or a three location mountain running series called the Under Armour Mountain Running Series. It kicks off in Mount Bachelor here in just a couple weeks, July 21st through the 23rd. And then and that's really our Pacific Northwest region, the volcanic region of the Pacific Northwest. And then we move to Killington, Vermont, and the Appalachian Trail, and we run a event series there. And then we move in September to the fall foliage in Copper Mountain and the Rocky Mountains and the Continental Divide. So we really wanted to give people across the country the opportunity to access a trail running event. And we're creating a series of events. We have seven different distances, so a 5K, a 10K, half marathon, and then we'll do a vertical running challenge at sunset. All of us know how energizing it is to kind of that golden hour of running, that sunrise and sunset. So we thought, you know, most races always start at dawn. Why not do a dusk run that finishes at the top of a mountain? Have some beers, come back down onto the gondola, and then we're going to do kind of a base camp festival atmosphere at these resorts, the last two resorts at Killington and Copper, where we just create a community atmosphere for trail runners to share their adventures, share their stories, and really get to know each other and talk about how to be better trail runners. And then the second day, we'll run a marathon and a championship 50K distance. So we thought that 50K was going to be a really great distance, just because there's so many kind of A races that ultra runners always look for in the summer at 50 miles and 100 miles. And so a solid 50K race can be a great training race for a lot of ultra runners. And we're offering a $5,000 prize money for the 50K to really garner and attract some of the best runners in North America.
Is that $5,000 at each venue or just one venue?
It's $5,000 at each venue, and that'll go to the top. That'll kind of cut across the top three men and women at each venue.
I like how that you're doing a festival type of scenario out there, because some of the best things about trail running is the community part. And so you've got some great runs and then a chance for people to mingle and get to know one another.
Yeah, I mean, what we thought, it's really cool because Under Armour actually partnered with Powder Corporation. They're one of the largest mountain resort operators in North America. They've got about 17 different resorts. And we kind of looked at their crown jewel resorts, Killington being kind of the crown jewel of the East. Copper is certainly a crown jewel of the Rocky Mountains. And then Bachelor being so close to Bend, and Bend's got such a cool trail running culture. And it really pulls a lot of the folks from Portland down on the weekends. We really felt like those three resorts would be great. And of course, mountain resorts are so well suited to host a sort of base camp atmosphere. You know, you're not in a obscure remote area, in, you know, kind of at the start finish line. We can create a better atmosphere and cool local breweries and coffee companies and food companies are integrating into these base camp areas. So we're excited about it. It's our first year. We're just getting it going. So for us, it's really about creating a great experience for the participants, for the runners, because we want to build this kind of this style and this format for the next several years. And we really just think it's a great format. I think there's a lot of people, especially whether they're in cities or they've just been running on the road and they're really intrigued by trail running. But when they go look at the calendar, it's kind of like a lot of races start at 50K and sometimes they just want to try it out. And that's why we love the format of like a 5K, 10K half marathon, just to give people that opportunity, that stepping stone to kind of experience, you know, real trail running and real mountain running.
Now, speaking of stepping stones, I've got to imagine that Under Armour has put some trail gear, specific trail gear out there. Are they introducing something that as trail runners will gravitate towards?
Yeah, cool. So we're starting from a place, you know, we're starting I think from a humble place, but we also have, you know, we've got the Under Armour brand, which is just filled with so many great people and innovative people and technologies that we can pull from. So it's I've kind of been like a kid in a candy shop here at Under Armour from the standpoint of being able to take some of the technologies that they're using in some of the other sports and look at how we could adapt those for trail running. And so we launched this year in just this spring, our Horizon series of trail running shoes. And it's a three shoe pack of shoes called our Horizon KTV, which is our highest end shoe. And then we have our Horizon RTT, And then we've got our kind of gateway training and trail running shoe called our Horizon STR. And they're all three just terrific shoes. We really built them on a really beautiful kind of cushioned ride, but they've got a more agile ride. Like a lot of footwear out there right now is all about the cushion, floaty, cruisy ride, but a lot of times those shoes we've found haven't had a really precise kind of agile fit. And so we've really focused on just creating a really kind of agile ride, a more of a sporty ride for trail runners. And we're getting a really good response. We've also built and we're working with a few key athletes this year in the trail running community. We're just getting a core team going. For us, it's not about building, you know, a big team. It's about building the right team of people that really want to be involved in helping us create something special with the footwear and with the apparel. And so we just started working with Io Wang and Cody Reed and Kelly Wolf that have all been kind of on the scene this year, just running great and really kind of testing out all the product and helping us tune it up.
Well, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, if you didn't know that Ultra Under Armour was in the running space, you should check out their trail running shoes online. Not only that, I assume they perform well, but they're pretty fancy looking shoes. They're real cool colors, and
that's a prerequisite for you, Scott. They've got to look fancy. They've got to look fast.
Better to look good and look fast than to actually perform.
Especially when you only have one choice.
These days, everyone expects both. They better look good first, and then they better be fast. So, I mean, our designers are crazy about making them look beautiful. That's always their first desire, and then of course we run them through the runners to make sure that that they work. You know, they work flawlessly because they can look good, but man, they better run beautifully.
Well, you should go check those out at the Ultra, Ultra Armour. That's what you guys should change their name to, is Ultra Armour, Under Armour website. And then also check out these races. The first one is next week, Don.
Yeah. It's
the one up in Oregon, the Cascade Volcano running series. Seven distances from 5K all the way up to 50K in a vertical challenge. You can sign up for these by going to uamountainrunning.com. The one in Vermont happens in August, and then the month after that in Colorado, Copper Mountain, Colorado.
Beautiful spots.
Right on, guys. We're hoping you'll be out there and get into one of these events. We'd love to have you out and experience the energy of this mountain running series we've got going.
Hey, we'd love to go. And go ahead, Scott.
I was just gonna say we were talking to some of your fellow workers, and there's already quite a few people that are registered. This is not a small bang out of, you know, first time running series. There's hundreds and thousands of people already signed up, right, Topher?
Yeah, what we wanted to do in the race continues to build energy, you know, as we've gotten the word out this year. And one of the reasons we really looked at hosting these at these three iconic North American resorts is, one, they have beautiful, spectacular scenery. it's the perfect time of year in each one of these locations. They're rugged and authentic. We wanted to have real courses, not just little, you know, either looped courses or so we really wanted rugged courses. And then it also allows us to run with larger kind of format or more people on the courses. As you guys know, a lot of races have very limited capacities, and so we've got larger capacity in these races. So it's just allowing us to, one, create more of that festival atmosphere at the start finish, that base camp atmosphere, but also we can have over 1,000 runners across the 7 different distances, and we're energized about it.
And this just in, we have a discount for Trail Runner Nation members.
Wow!
So if you want to get a discount, we can give you a 20% discount if you go to the website, which I just said, it is uamountainrunning.com. You can get a 20% discount if you enter the code TRNATION.
Good. Hey,
right on, guys. We'd love to have you, and we'd love to have your listeners come and experience an incredible day or weekend in the mountains.
Hey, Topher, you've done some great work with other brands, and
yes,
we look forward to you escorting this brand into awareness and to great function out there. So you're representing us, and thanks for getting it done.
Awesome, you guys. Great talking with you. Thanks so much.
All right, we'll talk soon.
See you on the trail soon.
You got it.
The store is open. Actually, when you come to think of it, the store never closes,
Don. It's a 24/7, 365 store. And Scott, I've been meaning to talk to you. I've been putting a lot of days in at the store. It's time for you to come and pull your weight.
Do you even know where the store is?
Yeah, it's right down the street from AJW's tap room.
It is that. We just want to remind you, we have some cool stuff there. We still have buffs. We have sleeves. We have the tri-colored hats.
You know, those are cool. Everybody loves those.
And if you happen to be a size that we still have some hoodies and some t-shirts from our last round. They're on extreme discount right now. And don't forget to pick yourself up some performance-enhancing Cocopelli temporary tattoos.
Scott, those are to help prevent bonks, make you run faster, make you perform better in all things that you do, including sleep, meal preparation, traffic lights, less time at traffic lights. I mean, your world changes when you apply a Cocopelli.
It just makes you feel better. Puts a smile on your face. You a better person. It makes you a kinder person.
They really work. So go to our website and enter the store and buy some of that gear Scott's talking about, or just some Cocopellis.
TrailRunnerNation.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. The group of the Nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And today we are talking to the authors of The Brave Athlete. You want to pick up the second part of the title?
Well, absolutely. I do want to pick
this
up this.
This one, if you're in a bookstore or you're surfing Amazon and you see this title, it's going to make you pause.
And I'm going to read the title, and then we need to look at the title. But before we get to that, Scott, what you always remind me
what's that
to do, we've got to introduce our guests. We've got to tell them who they are.
Well, this was part of the introduction. I said the authors of the book.
The Brave Athlete, Calm the F Down.
And rise
to the occasion. Good. Introducing our authors here are Simon Marshall and Leslie Patterson. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Thank you so much.
Simon and Leslie are married.
Ah, okay.
And they're both endurance athletes.
Spoiler alert.
Big time. Many an argument going on here, that's for sure.
Good.
That's right.
Oh. So tell us about some of your athletic exploits. I know that you're both involved in endurance sports and have been at it for a while, so share with us a little bit about you.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm first off a rugby player. And if anyone has met me, you can tell by my stature, of course. I'm 6 foot tall and 200 pounds. And no.
She's not. She's an Oompa Loompa.
And if you believe that, I have some land in Florida that has some really nice swampiness to it.
I have a feeling right now some Google image searches are happening.
Yeah, right. Listen, she puts lots of loose change in her pocket. She's maybe 100 pounds.
I did start in rugby playing with all boys, and you know, I was only allowed to play until the age of 12, and you know, couldn't really find anything else to get into because they didn't have any women's teams, you know, at the time. We're talking in the 80s here.
In Scotland.
And in fact, if I was to go to a women's team now, I would just be, I mean, have you seen the size of these women that play rugby now?
Yes, they're not 100 pounds with coins in their pockets. I know that.
Exactly. I'd get squashed. I'd be the ball. I wouldn't be the player. I'd be the ball and be tossing.
Hey, Leslie, did you make any boys cry back then? Did you hit them hard enough that you'd make them cry?
She Absolutely. Still does. She's done that for 15 years. It's called marriage.
Daily, on the daily.
That's an interesting background, very unique background.
And some triathlete stuff, as I had read. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been a triathlete for, gosh, 26 years. So I started really young and, you know, was really competitive really quickly, you know, very, very serious about it and very intense. That's kind of my nature, you know. So my dad had to find something to get rid of all my energy, and triathlon was very fitting. So, you know, kind of got in the Scottish national team and, you know, British national team, and had huge aspirations to go to the Olympics. In fact, I remember when I was about 4 years old watching the Olympics and watching Zola Budd and Steve Cram run at the Olympics, and I used to pretend I was Zola Budd. I'd run in bare feet around the grass by my house, and my best mate, who was a boy, would pretend he was Steve Cram. Of course, I always had to win. But long story short, I just had huge aspirations to go to the Olympics, and you know, the format of racing, ITU racing for triathlon relies heavily on you being a really good swimmer. And unfortunately, I just wasn't. So I pretty much got my arse whipped and never realized my potential, and kind of gave up at the age of 20, completely disillusioned.
Now, I've got to ask you, Simon, did your endurance accomplishments start with trying to chase Leslie down, or did you actually sign up for sports?
I never think it's a good idea to do three sports. I'm average at one. I don't need to be average at three. It's just too much for my ego to handle. So I started off like most English boys did, you know, playing football, soccer, cricket and rugby and so on. Then I played tennis, and I'm a jock at heart. But then I got into cycling, and I was really a competitive cyclist from the age of 12. Raced quite a lot, a fairly high amateur level, and but only did one sport. I enjoyed it, but just didn't have the you know, the X factor, also known as talent, to make it into, you know, the big leagues. But I met Leslie. We were at uni. I was finishing my PhD in sports psychology, and the GB national team, triathlon team, were based there. So Leslie was the only girl that used to come out on our men's road team rides. And triathletes are, I don't know if you know many triathletes, they're a fucking weird lot. I'm married to one. I work with a lot of them. You know, they gravitate to the sport because they have a little bit of neuroticism, anxiety, and self-absorption. And you know, well, listen, you have to spend so much time devoted to it. And there's three different activities, three things to worry about. So, but they're, you know, up at 5 a.m. swimming, and road cyclists don't really do anything before 10 a.m., you know. So it wasn't exactly a match made in heaven sport-wise. But we were fortunately able to do a lot of riding together. But this is when Leslie had just given up the sport. So she was getting more unfit, and I was getting fitter. So there was a lovely crossover period where I actually could put the hurt on her. But then when she got back into the sport through cross-country running, she just started to annihilate me. So that's when I started to have a revision of my athletic self-concept.
Now, the interesting combination between the two of you, and we'll go down the road of Leslie's career from when she gave up triathlons. But you met at university. Simon, you continued on and got your PhD. Tell us a little bit of your background in education and where you are now. Why this qualifies?
Yeah, my background, undergraduate degree in sports science. So you're studying exercise physiology, biomechanics, and sports psychology, run the gamut, and then you specialize in your final year. So I chose sports psychology, and then I did a master's degree in sport in kinesiology with a focus on sports psychology, and then a PhD. If I wasn't running out of degrees to do, eternal student in sport psychology, and then I started working with quite a lot of athletes, but I got a little bit disillusioned. Just as Leslie, actually, as we met, this is one of the things that we connected on. I got a bit disillusioned with working with professional athletes or elite athletes, because it was really, as a psychologist, you're nurturing more dysfunction in a way. You know, they're asking you to do things faster, higher, quicker, whatever, and really what they're asking for is, I want to make my life even narrower than it already is and more obsessed and so on. And so, I did, at the same time, I was moving into the psychology, but applied to public health. So helping people make lifestyle decisions, nutrition and physical activity and so on. So I did a postdoctoral fellowship in behavioral science, a long-winded way of saying, you know, you're using sort of behaviors, nutrition and activity to help people improve their lives. And then I got a faculty position out in California. So that's when we both moved out to the U.S. and spent 12 years as an academic research and teaching faculty in the School of Medicine, in behavioral medicine at the University of California, San Diego. So, and then left a couple of years ago. Leslie and I started coaching, and it was a lot more fun. I was getting a bit burnt out as well, and trying to walk the talk with some of the messages in our book about finding passions and jumping and feeling fear and doing it anyway. I left academia to do this full time, and I really haven't looked back since.
Go ahead, Sam.
So now we're going to shift back over to Leslie. So Leslie, you were at university, early 20s, I think, and you decided this triathlon stuff. Why did you give it up? Why did you get burned out?
Yeah, totally. I got burnt out, you know, and I think that the love of, and the passion of the sport was just kind of drawn out of me. You know, when you're on a national squad, and in the UK, it's based around lottery funding. It's very intense. You know, the coaching is very intense, very metric based, data driven. A lot of the coaches at the time just didn't know how to talk to me. In fact, they would ignore me if I had a bad race. You know, they would just, they would tell me all sorts of things. You're too fat, you're not good enough, you know, just, there was a lot of just, you know, that sentiment of you're just never quite good enough. And I lost my confidence. And then, you know, not only that, you know, I grew up in this gritty environment of rugby and then in the hills of Scotland and, you know, was constantly sort of out there in the mountains. And then ITU racing was like doing the circuits, you know, of cities. And it was wank.
That means it wasn't very enjoyable. Right.
Occasionally, we'll need a little translation.
That's right. Yeah. I don't want to know exactly what that means.
I was gonna give you guys a little bit of preparation to learn about Don and I. We are experienced linguists. Okay. There's some YouTube videos that are floating around the black web out there of Don and I. With our cunning
accents.
What's coming?
I think Warren Paul, who's one of your compadres over there, said we
countrymen.
We sounded like Lucky Charms and Benny Hill smashed together.
Oh my god!
It wasn't good.
That's a compliment.
hey, Dr. Simon, I have a question for you. Are elite athletes psychologically stable?
Leslie, depends. Plug your ears.
It depends, A, what you mean by stable, and B, what kind of sport you're talking about. But we, you know, it's funny, we have this conversation a lot, and one of the things that in endurance sport especially, and triathlon is one that I know most of, but ultra is probably very similar, trail running, is that, you know, the question is, do we see quite a lot of people who have a higher degree, and the research supports this, more anxiety, more neuroticism than other sports, endurance sports do. And so is it because that this sport turns them into this, or are they attracted to this because they have these personalities? And the research actually is pretty consistent, showing that people with these personality types are drawn to these sports. So it does certainly seem to provide an avenue for folks to kind of act out or enable some of the characteristics they already have. So you find people that have quite high needs for control. You get a lot more obsessive tendencies in endurance sport. And so, yeah, it's interesting. And I've got some of those tendencies myself. Leslie certainly does. But I think that, so when you talk about stable, we often, in psychology, we talk about, is it clinically relevant, which is a polite way of saying, do you need some help with it? or are you kind of like the rest of the population? And endurance sport, endurance athletes, particularly those who, the more training you do and the better you get, seem to walk that line between those two lines. So it's a bit like, we're trying to keep them from completely going off the ledge, but they're not most normal people's lifestyles. They can't really relate to that kind of lifestyle itself. So it's kind of walking a fine line.
So if you're listening to this and you're saying, well, I'm not that, and I'm not that either, so Simon must be a little bit off, you're in denial. You're in denial at this point, because if you're in the community, you're probably one of us.
That's exactly true. In fact, one of the cognitive biases we all have is our inability to know what we're not very good at. So, you walk right into that one.
And I interrupted you, Leslie. What were you about to say?
Well, I can't remember now.
Oh.
Gotta be very exciting.
I think that's one of the things that this book brings out is all of us have had thoughts and feelings that we don't want. Whether that's in our endurance sport or whether it's in our family, our interpersonal relationships, or in our career, these thoughts creep into our mind. This book kind of helps that. Helps. Right. And I think that's where I really want to get into this. I'm really curious, Leslie and Simon. So you gave up triathletes and all of a sudden now you're back. How did you get back? Was it Simon doing his voodoo psychological magic on you?
Easy now. Easy.
There is a PhD after your name. You have
that's
that
right.
capability.
No, I used my PhD to get her to marry me, but then after that it was...
It was a funny one because I felt like I needed to rediscover myself because my identity was as this failed athlete, right? And yeah. So I'd always, in fact, I studied my undergraduate in drama at university. So I've always had this other side of me, which is very creative. And so, getting into professional sport kind of quelled that because you find all of these hours of monotonous training can kind of numb you of emotions and thoughts and feelings. And so I really didn't know where I was. And so I felt like going back to university and studying a master's degree in theatre and acting would kind of help me discover some of that. And so, I did that, went up to Los Angeles, starred in a number of student films and crappy, horror films and all sorts of nonsense. It's thoroughly embarrassing now that I look back at it because I was actually kind of shit. but, it really, I got excited about life again. I really discovered who I was and what I liked and began to develop a confidence about the way that I do things because previously I'd looked at other athletes that were successful and thought, well, if I'm not like them, then I can't be a world champion like them. And then I came to the realization that everyone has their own pathway and that's okay. So essentially over the next kind of from 2006 onwards, once I discovered Xterra, kind of developed my own techniques and my own ways of doing things and got new coaches that really listened to me and, developed new philosophies and then would come home every night and speak to Si about it and be like, hey, babe, this is what I felt, this is what I did and what does this mean and why do I do this? And he would break it down from a scientific perspective. And I think by doing that, I got him reinvigorated about sport and sports psychology again. And we kind of went on this journey together.
So I guess my first question is, are you really an Xterra champion or are you acting like you're a Xterra champion? You're playing a part.
Interestingly, you say that because I actually have my own alter ego that I race under. And that's in the book also. So, I race as my alter ego is called Paddy McGinty and he's an Irish MMA boxer. So, in fact, it is not Leslie who has won. It's Paddy. So you were right.
Do you have a character?
It's funny because, alter egos or thinking of yourself in that, we've talked about this in the past, about thinking of yourself in the third person is really helpful therapeutically. It's used in psychotherapy for extensively for lots of different reasons. But actually, you can do it when you feel nervous or apprehensive about something, or a challenge requires attributes that you don't think you have. And rather than have 5 years of intensive psychotherapy and all kinds of, you know, meds to calm you down, it's often just you can fake it. And fake it till you make it is actually now an evidence-based statement. With a whole host of changes in your brain chemistry within a couple minutes change, your thoughts change, your feelings change, and you can actually go through and deal with stressful stuff by pretending to be someone else. It's actually a really useful technique generally.
So you have, Simon, you have all this book learning, lots of textbooks, yeah. lots of research projects, yeah. and so you have this idea in your head of how an athlete should think and feel.
Yeah.
When Leslie is coming home saying, this is how I feel today, this is what I felt on my run, this is what I'm thinking, did it mirror up, or did you find that there were some fallacies in those books?
Yeah, my books were useless.
Really?
The problem was is that, you know, when you're taught and you're trained in sports psychology, you're trained primarily through, you know, textbooks and journal articles, and then you do some supervised experience and internship hours and the rest of it. But a lot of the techniques, they didn't seem to resonate with the way that real athletes thought. And you know, it's not a good sign when I'm looking at it, you know, thinking about myself as an athlete, thinking, would I do this? Well, I'm not really sure, you know, and you're trying to get an athlete convinced about it. So, you know, one of the classic ones is about, you know, using visualization, you know, seeing in your mind's eye an event or pre-creating something is a really useful strategy. But the way that it's typically used in sports psychology, you sit down and you visualize yourself winning or success, being successful, none of that seemed to bloody work. And the athletes would roll their eyes, and athletes are very action oriented. And if you give them a lot of things to just lie there and think about, they're not going to do it. I'll tell you right now, they're not going to do it. And they'll tell you they do it and they don't. And so being married to a professional athlete, you know, the peek behind the curtain of what actually happens changed my perspective about what techniques could work and wouldn't work, because I felt I could talk their language a little bit more. I mean, I could talk as an athlete, but, you know, I don't get much credibility talking with Olympic champions or professional athletes if you've never been at that level yourself. And so, but now I've kind of talked the language of Leslie's head as well. And that's what this book really represents. And I think that's really why it's been received quite well, is because it's really getting into those issues, that the issues, how they appear in athletes' heads, and not trying to, you know, pretend that just some sort of looking and standing in front of the mirror saying, I'm strong, I'm successful, and I'm a winner, you know, is going to help. Because we've tried all those things and none of those bloody help.
We're talking about the brave athlete, calm the F down and rise to the occasion. And if you've kind of picked up, these two authors are pretty animated. The pages are just as animated. I mean, there's great illustrations and pictures and the way that it reads. So it's a great book. I have a question. You know, every athlete has their peak. There's a time that they're performing at their best. In our athletic careers, we hope to be lifelong. How does an athlete deal with decreased performance or best races behind them and still engage and grasp the sport? How do we handle that?
You know, I think you have to be really in tune with your why. Why did you ever start the sport, and what does it mean to you? Because I am currently going through that. Now, not to say that my best days are behind me, but certainly I've had a very big struggle over the last 4 years, dealing with a lot of health issues, Lyme's disease, injuries. I've had performances that are amazing, then terrible, and amazing, then terrible. And, you know, I came off the back of an incredible, you know, two back-to-back wins at Xterra Worlds, and then into my season in 2013, where I was like invincible. And unfortunately, I took it too far and kind of fell off the cliff the other side of it. And, you know, every day I have to focus on gratitude. You know, if I'm having an issue, you know, maybe I'm having a flare up of Lyme, or I'm in a lot of pain, or whatever, you know, the issue is I'm dealing with, I focus on what's important to me about why I do this, and where is the gratitude piece. I'm lucky enough to have, you know, find some amazing peaks. But more importantly, you know, for me, it's about the community I'm a part of. It's about sharing my experiences, helping others through their tough times, and just looking about and being like, wow, I mean, how lucky are we? You know, I mean, very, very privileged to do what we can do, to have the money, to have the support, and to have the education to do this. So gratitude is a huge piece, and knowing your why is the other one.
So how has your why changed from your early 20s to now?
I don't think it's the why that's changed. I think it's a level of gratitude and maturity and how you deal with situations that's changed. My why has always been the same. I love to feel my body move through space out in the environment of the hills and the mountains and the wind and the rain and the sun. And I like the primal sense of what it is that I do. You know, and I think as well, that's why ultra running and all these kind of things are just so popular, you know, even things like Spartan races and whatnot, because there is that primal essence of getting down to the basics of life. What does it mean when you push yourself right to the limit and the edge? You look deep into your soul when you do that. And that's a powerful and wonderful thing. And it's a form of therapy. And I think the world that we're living in now that seems so stressful and complex and frustrating, you know, the simplicity of those moments, that's what we crave as athletes, I think, and that will never change whether I'm 5 years old or whether I'm, you know, 55 years old.
I know that's a very, very good answer. I've got to think if your why is to stand on a podium, mm-hmm. you're going to be disappointed because, you know, that's a short-lived period. But if your why is to be primal and to exist and to be free and to just get out there in space and move and feel
move
the
through
elements,
space.
Yeah, that yeah. why never goes away, regardless of your speed, your pace, where you end up in the finish. It doesn't matter because your why is always hit. I think that's important to do.
But what's interesting in this is that a lot of athletes make this connection between finding joy and gratitude, and almost as though it's a resignation of some sort, an acceptance of, well, it's just for fun. That's to miss the point, because actually the reality is that some of the best performances you can have are when you're in that state. So it's related to performance as well. And so what we're trying to get athletes to do all the time is to say, you know, when we say, what's your job as an athlete? It's really to execute a process that you know how to do already, but you're trying to do it flawlessly and as efficiently and as possible. And so in the moment, what are the things that you can do to help you have the best performance? And it isn't worrying about the outcome or splits or times or placings. It's about effort and attitude. You've only got two things that you can really ever control, is your effort and your attitude. And if you're constantly asking yourself, am I giving it everything I've got, given my circumstances today and how much I've got still to go, and am I giving an making an effort to stay as positive as I can, and really when you cross the line, if you can answer those two questions with your hand on your heart and say yes and yes, nothing more can be asked of you. And we've got good evidence to show that some of the athletes who have had their best performances, their peak performances, that's the experience they've actually had to get there.
You know, I'm really glad you brought up the phrase perception of effort. You mentioned, and I'm going to kill this because I'm not an academic, the anterior cingulate cortex, the ACC. Is that right?
That's close enough.
Close enough.
You got the ACC right. If you nailed the ACC.
If I didn't pronounce it right, just pretend I was using one of my accents.
one of them.
So that's a part of the brain, and you can confirm this. I could be totally high.
Yes, I can confirm it's part of the brain, yes.
Okay. That's a part that regulates a perception of effort, self-control, and social pain. Can we train that part of the brain?
Yeah, absolutely you can. In fact, this is a big debate, not just in the athletic world now, the, you know, sports science-y type athletic world, but also in physiology in general. And there's this notion that the brain actually plays quite as big a role than we thought in regulating effort. It's known as the central governor theory. And we always thought that, you know, fatigue, things that make us pull up on the trail and stop, were peripheral, that muscle fatigue, lactic acid, you know, all the things that, or glycogen depletion and so on. And we know that that's not the whole story. We know that parts of our brain really dictate when we actually send the signal, look, enough's enough. And so the part of your brain, the anterior cingulate cortex, is right behind your eyes, and it regulates your ability to detect discomfort. So you're getting signals from your muscles, from your respiratory system, from your blood, from pressure sensors all over your body, and they're fed to this part of your brain. And your brain then makes a calculation about how much do we want to make that you feel these sensations? And one of the things that we think it does is that it one processes obviously the direct input, you know, whether the kind of the pain, the nociception, as it were, the pain itself. But the other thing is, how much longer do I have to endure this for? And so that's that. And so its role is what we call anticipatory regulation, a really fancy way of saying, before I tell you how much I'm going to tell you this hurts, I'm going to say, okay, what's the incoming sensation plus how long do I think you're going to have to endure it for? And those two things combined are going to tell you how you then perceive it. That's what perceived exertion actually is. But the kicker here is that part of your brain also processes social pain, and also processes self-control. So for example, if you've had to write tons of emotional checks that day because you've had an argument with your spouse or something's gone wrong, then the bandwidth to process that effort is smaller. So we know that when you're feeling down emotionally or you've got a lot of shit going on, effort feels harder, and it does feel harder because your brain is telling it that way. So the way that we train this is, and we know this from studies, not just our, I mean, it's very hard to do like experimental randomized controlled trials of this to force people to face it and then measure the thickness or density of your ACC. But we do it using what we call cross-sectional data. So we look at people who have large ACCs, meaning they're large in volume and density, and we look at the kinds of experiences they've had in life, and we compare them to people who haven't. And then we try and, you know, we have to kind of make a few assumptions. And so what that tells us is that adversity in your life, whether it's physical or social pain or physical pain or social pain, tends to correspond to have a thicker ACC. So there's no, this is why it's probably no coincidence that elite endurance athletes, I'm talking about not just professionals, but the top 10% of professional athletes seem to have there's a much higher incidence of emotional and physical trauma in their childhoods, for example, than other endurance athletes. So now it's not to say that, you know, you need this, you need to have an abusive childhood to be good as an elite athlete. But what we do know is that you need to force yourself to face adversity if you're going to get better at it. Your brain is physically changing in response to it. So we set mental toughness sessions that athletes say, I don't think I can do this. Who do you think I am? That's what we're trying to get them to do, because it's only then when you start to redraw the sand in the line in the sand of what's possible, but your brain is physically adapting so that you're better able to cope with those things in the future.
So Scott mentioned coaching at the beginning, and if I wanted you to work on my ACC, would I contact you guys for coaching? Because
that's right.
I am interested in developing, I think, a bigger ACC or getting my ACC smaller. Which direction do I want to go with my ACC?
You want it to get bigger.
Okay, bigger. And I can come to you.
If it gets smaller, you become wimpier.
So I come to you and you'll help develop my ACC.
If Don and I are sitting at the opposite end of this table and it's a scale and we're looking at size of ACC.
Yeah, we're comparing size. Scale.
I'm in the basement.
Well, it is scaled to body mass as well. Not that I can see the size of your BMI as the two of you, but so we have to scale it relatively.
I'm still in the basement, Simon. Hey, Leslie, this is a question I have for you. And I can't remember if I read somewhere in the book or if it was something that I read that you wrote outside of the book that really hit me and really made sense to me. And I want to get your opinion on this. Most everyone's pain threshold is the same, but individuals' tolerance for pain can vary differently.
Yeah.
Can you explain Leslie, and tell us about your threshold versus your tolerance?
Sure.
Before Leslie just talks about her experience as an athlete, let me just put a caveat to that. Because I know that, you know, that if you do have any science or people who are kind of, they're going to like, well, wait, what are you talking about? So just to be clear, what we're talking about is with your sort of pain detection is the point at which people feel pain. So this is now your pain threshold, is pretty much the same for everyone. So, you know, going, and we know this studies from when you prick someone with a pin or you immerse someone's forearm in ice bucket or when you get them to run hard, people feel pain around the same, but your tolerance, how long you can survive during that feeling, is what separates athletes. So it's kind of a slight, it's a small distinction, but
And I think that, like, obviously my background, right, in developing my ACC from a young age has helped my tolerance or my perception of pain and my ability to sustain. I mean, I've had a fire in my belly since I was very, very young. But, for instance, when I was playing rugby, I was playing against all boys who would laugh and joke and point at me, and I had to suck it up. You know, I didn't have a changing room. It was cold. It was wet. It was often snowing. I had to go into a toilet at 7 years old and wash myself in the sink, you know, to try and get warm. So all of these little experiences across the years made me tougher and tougher and tougher, developed my ACC. And now I'm at the point where I feel like I've coped with so much that my level of tolerance and my sort of ability to adapt to situations is greater than most. But I also seek it out. You know, I'm one of those people that seeks it out, just like Simon was saying, that our sports attract certain type of people. I am that certain type of person.
But when you look at it, if you look on a race and you look at someone, take just a 10K, someone who's right at the back, it might be their first race, they're running at 12, 13 minute mile pace, that how hard it feels to them is the same for the person who's running 32 minutes. It's the same, but the difference is the person who's running 32 minutes can endure that level of pain for much longer. And training helps that. Exercise, you know, being exposed to adversity helps that. And some psychological, some mental strategies as well. But it feels the same. They're just going faster.
And I think you just answered the question I was just going to ask, that individual's tolerance for pain is variable. You can develop that. Whereas the threshold doesn't vary. I mean, it's a set point. You don't adjust that. But the tolerance you can set.
If you
want to be an endurance athlete, if you want to run 100 miles, or if you're crazy like Don and want to run 200 miles, you have to develop that tolerance.
Big time.
You were talking about ACC training, Scott. Naturally, we all know that, right?
Do you know what ACC stands for, Don?
No, it's in the show notes. Hey, where was I going? I had to go.
I don't know. You had a good question, didn't you?
I did. I have a very good question. That's one reason it's good to get out there and train with other people and other groups, because it pushes you through and helps develop that threshold and extend it, because heck, you're around your peers. If you're by yourself, you might pack it in early, but getting a good training group and going out with runners that maybe are a little bit better than you, and you catch up to them, not only physiologically, you can improve cardiovascular, etc., but I've got to think there's some good mind training when you get in the groove with a group.
Absolutely.
So I periodize my training partners, because I don't think you can be in that space all the time when you're pushing yourself to the edge, because it's incredibly exhausting and emotionally draining. So there's certain times of the year where, you know, I'll have different people that I like to train with, or where I'll put myself, just like Simon said, there's only so many emotional checks that you can write. So, you know, I have a very different group of people, you know, when I'm building up to a race that I train with, than maybe in my winter months where I'm wanting to do base work. And I think it's just good to have that variety anyway, so that, you know, for instance, this week I'm building up for a race, and I was out training with a lot of the elite men on the bike and running as well. And man, I felt crap. Well, geez, I'm a world champion, you know, but I was huffing and puffing and hanging on. And so for me, that sort of put my confidence in the toilet. So there's a time and a place to sort of know when to push those limits and to do that ACC training. So, you know, it's a delicate balance. And, you know, obviously we don't want to be doing mental toughness training sessions if you're injured, you know, or if you're overtrained, or, you know, it's always that delicate physical mental balance that we're trying to work towards all the time as coaches and as athletes.
Hey, you talked about going out there and pushing the envelope of being extremely difficult, and you can't always write that emotional check. Last night we've had many nights in a row here of just some tough training, but last night was an easy run. And I think that did a lot for self-confidence of going back to an easy run and it feeling easy all the way through, and it used to feel hard. It was probably more valuable to me to go easy and feel good about it than put in a real hard workout. I think I took a leap forward because – it was easy and it felt easy. And I established that my training has been working. Mm-hmm. So sometimes taking it easy can be a real, real treat and an advantage. Is there truth to that?
It's a reward. It's a reward for you. And I don't think that people, you know, I work very much in extremes, you know, in that, you know, I'll have very hard sessions and very easy sessions. And people are always shocked when they come out running with me and I'm running 10 minute miles and I'm a, you know, sort of 16 minute 5K runner. They're like, what are you, you know, oh, what? And, you know, it's just like, you know, for me, easy is easy, you know, and I really want to be able to have that conversation, have that social interaction, look at the view, think about other things and have a different experience. And a lot of runners either feel guilty or they want to push themselves or they want to push against other people. So you've got to have confidence in your own journey and what's right mm-hmm. for you. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing because being around other people can bring out the best and the worst in you.
Right. Yeah. And I think that speaks to, you know, what some of the factors that contribute to your ability to tolerate pain or discomfort. We often talk about discomfort when we really mean pain. We don't like to use the word pain because people think, oh, I can run through injuries. But so I think we're on the same page when we're talking about exercise effort pain. But the external things, of course, are doing the exercise with other people. It's one of the most common robust psychological findings. They call it social facilitation. Again, a fancy way of saying that you do better when you're around other people, even if you're not drafting off them or even if there's no other tangible mechanical or physiological benefit to it. We just do. And this has been replicated not just in sport, but in a whole host of silly little tasks like how quick you can reel in fishing line and that kind of stuff. So that's one thing. The other external things, obviously listening to music, that's another huge ergogenic aid on performance, and there are good sort of neurological reasons why that is as well. And then the third is having quite a variety of things in your environment. So the notion that when you run in fairly sterile environments versus very environmentally rich features, a lot of flora and fauna and nice aesthetically pleasing, it feels better. And again, this is another robust finding that, you know, this is why perception of effort on a treadmill is very different than perception of effort out on a trail, all other things being held constant. So I think you can manipulate those three things. If you're not going to do anything to work on like mental strategy in your own head, but all of those things improve your ability to tolerate.
Now, Leslie, I have to take issue with you for a moment because,
hey, Don.
Yeah.
She played rugby. You don't want to take issue with her.
I know, but we're
she'll knock you.
We're a ways apart.
Okay.
And then she was talking about running and somebody saying, this seems slow for a world-class athlete. And she said, whoa, whoa, whoa. She kind of used an American accent then when she was kind of giving the doofus response.
Gosh, don't tell my dad that.
My goodness. Hey, I've often talked, and I think I was talking about the ACC a long time before I even knew the term, because that's mm-hmm. recent for me. And I talked about a fuse. A fuse pops when it's overloaded. And I thought of runners having different fuses. And I wondered if this fuse existed, if we took my fuse out and put Scott's in my head or put mine in his head, when that tolerance level, when that would pop. And when it pops, you shut down, you back off, you go, oh, that's too much, I can't tolerate that. I'm wondering what kind of runner I would be if I had somebody else's fuse in my head. If their ACC was planted in me, what's my potential? How much is that fuse or that ACC holding me back from running faster? Or maybe I'm running way beyond my capacity.
You took the fuse out and put a piece of tinfoil in there? Is that what you're saying?
I don't
you're
know
not
if
even
that's
using
better.
A fuse.
Yeah, maybe I'm directly wired. I don't know.
Yeah.
So these
are deep existential issues. I love it. but I think this is also a case for the alter ego, right? If you want to try on someone else's fuse, you actually can at least put the skin or imagine the attributes they have. And we know that actually helps. And in our book, we try and lay out this kind of alter ego development kit to help people do that. But I think the fuse analogy is a nice, I haven't even thought of that. I'm going to steal that. Thanks for that.
You can. I'm stealing from you right now. Go ahead.
Yeah. But the fuse issue is about trying on someone else.
else's pain tolerance and discomfort. And I think that there's really no way to kind of have that in, well, there are some efforts to try and do that now with some of this transcranial stimulation therapies for athletes. I don't know if you're familiar with any of these, but running small electrical currents or magnetic forces from through your temple to help retrain or to help cope with things with different, I know.
We've never done that.
Show on just the next, 2.0 gadgets for sport.
Don't try this at home, right?
Exactly. Don't try this at home. Yeah, I've got a magnet on one side and a toaster oven on the other, and I'm seeing if I can make this work. But yeah, I think the alter ego is the closest thing that we could to actually to find that out, because athletes do are able to persist longer and cope with different things if they are assuming the character of someone else. So maybe that's a good way to test that theory.
But also as well, it comes down to how much can you control your performance by effort and God, what's the book you're reading at the moment?
Oh, Grit.
Grit.
Yeah.
You know. Talk about that.
Angela Duckworth has written this great book. If you haven't read it already, I really recommend it. It's called Grit. It's really, she's a sort of a Harvard-trained neuroscientist and psychologist and looks at the role of talent and talent being vastly overrated, and it's perseverance and persistence in the face of tough circumstances that really separates us out. What makes us better, some people better than others? There's another great, I'm pushing other people's books. Why am I? I'm an idiot. I don't know why. But another great book is by Matt Fitzgerald, How Bad Do You Want It? Really talks about the ACC in quite a lot of detail in it, and he's got such a lovely written style, and it's talked through anecdotes and stories. And so these are great little windows into real life people of how they're both their backgrounds and also some of the training they do to develop some of these characteristics so that they can actually persist longer than they would be than they would do normally.
And I would say buy their books only after you buy The Brave Athlete, Calm the F Down and Rise to the Occasion by Simon Marshall and Leslie Patterson. Go ahead.
Hey, so, you know, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to get into something that also intrigued me about the book. My first question goes to you, Simon, because you're the academic. And then I'm really interested to hear Leslie's point of view on this. And
I'm really interested in yours, Simon. Go ahead. Scott's interested in Leslie. I don't want you to feel short shrift here. I'm really interested in the doctor's opinion. Go ahead, Scott.
The whole idea of the chimp brain versus the professor brain. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I know. Right, it's sort of a bit of an eye opener when you first recognize that we all have more than one brain, and some of us question that assumption when the people that we meet, but our brains have evolved over millions of years, and parts of it have evolved at a different rate than others. So if 4 million years ago, you didn't have the much of a wrinkly outer cortex that when you look at a brain that you see. You had sort of that a kind of a fairly primitive brain inside that we still have. It's called the limbic system, or scientists call it the limbic system. And in it are things like the amygdala and the hippocampus and all these other sort of Latin names for these ancient structures that drive things like the fight or flight response and the source of all emotions and fear and all, and the limbic system right deep in your brain, if you cut it open, it's the part right in the middle, size of probably a couple of avocados. Or one California avocado. And that part of your brain, we call it, we didn't name it a chimp, a guy called Steve Peters, another great book, The Chimp Paradox, should be on your must reading list. Your limbic system or your chimp brain is this little emotional catastrophic machine that's trying to keep you alive. And whenever you feel an emotion, that's where it's coming from. Whenever you feel scared or frightened or lustful or shameful or guilty, it's coming from your chimp brain. And it processes information 5 times quicker than other parts of your brain. There are physiological reasons and evolutionary reasons why it does that. But the bottom line is that it gets a head start on threatening situations before your conscious, rational thinking brain, your wrinkly cortex, frontal cortex, has had a chance to even know what's going on.
May I interrupt and say, and that's why you feel it in your gut before you even actually understand what it is that you're afraid of. You feel it throughout your body.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly
Go ahead.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's exactly right. So, and in fact, there are good neural connections between your gut and your brain anyway, and that's a whole other discussion, but absolutely. You feel
you feel these emotions and you feel these sensations way before your rational brain has had a chance to catch up with it. We always thought in some sense that's what a sixth sense was. You know, there's something quite not right. I don't know what it is. It's not magical at all or mystical. It's just that your subconscious limbic system has been able to process this information much quicker. And then the next thing it does is that when it does feel threatened, and threatened meaning nowadays it doesn't know the difference between just starting on putting yourself on a start line, it thinks you're about to be eaten or used as a toy, you know, for some large mammal millions of years ago, which would have been the case. And so it gives you all these reactions. And then the next thing it does, so that you can't think your way out of a life and death situation, it throws a chemical brick at the rest of your brain. All these neurotransmitters are released. So it makes your frontal cortex a bit even lazier and slower at reacting, because it doesn't want you to say, oh, is that a gun? It could be a pen. Let's go and find out. You know, it needs you to run the hell away.
Yeah.
But of course, we don't live with just that. We also have a thinking, rational brain, what we call the professor brain. And the professor brain, unlike your chimp, only deals in facts, logic, and truth. And so if we only had that, we'd make perfectly sensible decisions. We'd never run 100 miles in one go and pay for it. So the fight here is between these two brains. On the one hand, your chimp is trying to keep you out of trouble and keep you alive and stop you feeling humiliated, embarrassed, or inadequate. And then your limbic system, your professor brain, your frontal cortex is saying, oh, it's just a race and don't worry about it. It's good for you. You're getting coached. You've paid for this and blah, blah. And then that fight is what causes most of the problems in having thoughts and things that we don't want. So that's the struggle. If you could reduce the science of psychology in terms of self helping people lead more enjoying, fulfilling lives, it would be that. It would be you have thoughts and feelings that you don't want that are causing you to avoid things or do things that you don't want to or wish you had or wish you could. And the reason is because you've got this fight between two different brains.
So Leslie, can you talk about your chimp brain and your professor brain? Is a professor... What was your alter ego?
Who's in control?
What was your alter ego name?
Patty McGinty.
Yes.
Is Patty McGinty a professor? Is that your professor brain?
No, he's definitely a chimp. For sure. But the good side of the chimp, right? The chimp is not all bad when it comes mm-hmm. to sort of, mm-hmm. you know, fighting, getting after it, some of those urges and just an ability just to go off intuition rather than to overthink things. Because, you know, me as a person, of course, I'm very analytical, so I'll overthink things. So it's good for me to actually, to a certain extent, come back to the chimp when I'm racing, just getting after it, that primal sense that I was talking about. My bad chimp talk is you know, a lot of it has to do with imposter syndrome, you know, not feeling like I belong, that I'm really going to get discovered, that I'm not as good as what everyone thinks I'm going to be. The expectation, you know, once you have been a good athlete, people are expecting that of you all the time. Body image issues, I feel fat, oh my gosh, look at this stupid outfit, my thighs are popping out, all of those kinds of things.
You know, that's, I think, maybe a common trait for mm-hmm. some people that are out there. How much do you think those items drove you or drive you to really perform well? Do they hold you back or do they push you forward in ways that if you didn't have them, you wouldn't perform as well? Do you think they're an advantage?
It's cyclical. So it's never something that you master. You master it in cycles. So I find I get to the point where I have those inner drives to want to master them. I get to the point where I do. I have good performances. I overdo it. They start to come back. They compromise the situation I'm in and I kind of fall off the wagon or the train or the cliff or whatever you want to call it. And then I have to pick up the pieces and build up again and learn mm-hmm. from my previous experiences. So I don't think it's ever something that you master ad infinitum. It's a constant journey of mastering, letting go, mastering, letting go.
And I think it's a team effort in terms of brains, right? So for good, the best performances are really when you've got your chimp and your professor brain working in harmony. And a good example is a couple of good friends of ours just did Marathon Disciples, and on the face of it, you know, the your chimp brain is saying, what the hell are you doing? You're going to run through the desert for 6 days and in the heat. And then your professor brain is really calculating how you're going to physically pull this off. And there are times where your professor brain has to be in control, making sure that you get your calories in and your hydration. And then your chimp brain is dragging your you're asked through the sand to get home without, you know, stopping. And so I think you have to have both in harmony. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, like Steve Peters, the guy who wrote a book called The Chimp Paradox, it is a paradox because it's both there as your best friend and your worst enemy, right? So you just have to know how to be better at managing your chimp so that it works for you when you need to kick up the ass and to bring it out, but it also doesn't make you make irrational or terrible decisions so that you screw your chances of doing well.
If you're on a run and you're listening to this and it sounds very interesting, but you can't picture it, buy the book on a page 202, a full animated picture of what's actually happening in your brain. You have a professor there with a headset on. You have a chimp with causing chaos. And you have all kinds of imagery that lets us understand exactly what it looks like. And I imagine right. The ACC is somewhere in this picture. I can't identify it right now, but it's
right.
Somewhere.
Yes.
It's a big sausage behind.
Yeah, we've reduced 50 years of neuroscience research to a picture. So clearly, there's
to a cartoon.
A cartoon even. It's not even a good picture, right? So clearly, we've had to make a few leaps of faith there.
Oh, and you can buy the T-shirt at www.
No. You should make a T-shirt of it. You have a T-shirt of this.
Yeah.
Is that on your website?
Stroke your chimp or what?
By the way, I assume it's on the store at braveheartcoach.com. That's their website.
Good.
And we'll link that, of course.
Yes.
This has been a very fun conversation, but I'm fearful that we've only scratched the surface of what's here.
You know, we've actually, I don't think we've gotten past the first chapter about Hello Brain. So, you know, I don't know if there's a way that we could twist your arm, you know, down the road, because there's some really cool topics that I would like to continue to dive into. The whole idea of visualization, you mentioned it very briefly at the beginning of the podcast, that we're always taught we should do this visualization or self-hypnosis to picture ourselves on the podium or doing well, and at least in trail running, ultra running, very few times does that actually happen. You can visualize it again and again and again, and if it doesn't happen, you kind of feel beaten down, and you guys bring up a much different way to visualize things that can go wrong and how you're going to adapt to that and react
That's
to that.
Exactly,
so.
Yeah, that would be the one take home from the visualization piece there, is to say, look, forget about imagining yourself winning. Your chimp can smell a rat from a bullshit from a mile away. Don't bother. Think about 10 things. List, use your professor brain to think about 10 things that could go wrong. Visualize them happening and then coming up with a contingency plan for every single one of them. You'll line up feeling prepared. You've got a contingency plan in place for anything that could go wrong. It'll boost confidence and you'll feel better doing it.
Hey, let's end with a question we probably should have started with, and that is, how did you come up with this title? What what inspired you, and how did you start with the title and write the book, or did the title write itself after the book was written?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is that the bravery theme is runs consistent through our coaching, and what we always say is that bravery really is, you know, not trying to force fear away, but accepting it and jumping hand in hand with it, face the fear, you know, and jump anyway. So there's an element of that to it. And then the calm the F down was really, look, most of us aren't doing this for a living, and we take it very seriously, and, you know, for good reason, we've got a lot of invested in it, our sunk costs of money and time and so on. The bottom line is that we need to stop occasionally to smell the roses, to get more gratitude and joy in it, and calm down, because it is a pastime. And once you find the ability to do that in stressful situations, not only do you feel better, but you get faster as well.
So braveheartcoach.com, you guys have coaching services. Tell us how if you hire this you're getting two people for the price of one.
You're assuming
you should charge double. Yeah. I'm just telling you right now. But what advantage does your coaching have over someone else out there? What can you bring to someone to help them?
Well, I think we really get to know the athlete, right? We get to know them as a person. And as a consequence, we can really get the best out of them, because I think a lot of the coaching nowadays is focused very much on data-driven outcomes. And there's wonderful things that come from following data, training peaks, Garmin, minute mile pace, blah, 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 TSS scores. That's wonderful. But if you don't really know that the athlete has had an argument the night before, then it doesn't mean shit. So, you know, I think it's the combination of really understanding how the physical and mental bodies work together and getting the best out of a person as a consequence. So we really, you know, I do a lot of the physical training, but then kind of get to know the person on a social level, and then Cy steps in and really kind of works his magic, and then we talk about it and I manipulate the training as a consequence. And it's this kind of, I think we just kind of create a team behind a person, and that's the goal.
And if you're interested, or even have an inkling, they have a thing, a link on their homepage called the Smog Test. It's basically, well, tell us what the Smog Test is. I think that's a great idea, by the way.
So the Smog Test is you just fill out and answer a couple questions, and then I call you up, no strings attached, and have a wee chin wag with you and chat about your training, give you a bit of advice. And it's always classic, though, because when I do call them up, they're never expecting it. So I'll be like, you know, they probably think it's some person trying to sell them something. I'm like, hello, this is Leslie Patterson here. They're like, sorry, who? I'm
like, I forgot Patterson, I filled that out.
Exactly.
So anyway, so yeah, they get a nice wee chin wag with me, and you know, if they're interested in coaching from that point, great. If they're not, then they've just gotten kind of a little bit of advice on what they're doing right or wrong.
Yeah, and I think it's also just a, you know, way to bounce other ideas off. And many folks who call us or contact us through that have coaches already, and we're not looking to poach them as athletes, but they just maybe they've been asked to do this, and or they're a particular you know, methodology to follow or style, and they're just interested in another. So we'll have a discussion with them, and we've got no vested interest in or bias in necessarily, because we don't know them, but it's nice to have a discussion. And to be honest, that's the way that we learn most, you know, about people, because obviously our own athletes are going to have a little bias as well. And so folks that don't we speak to once and maybe twice, we don't hear from them again, we doesn't charge them anything, it's just a nice to chat to them, we learn a lot from that as well, because it tells us about what athletes are looking for and what they're currently doing. And so it's a mutually beneficial experience.
We'll include the definition of chin wag in the show notes for
those
of you.
I still don't know
what that is.
Well, think about it. When your chin wags, your mouth's moving, right? So you're talking. Okay.
Yeah, my voice.
Hey, and this would be the perfect time for us to try to commit you to come back on again sometime, because
you can't say no.
Because it's tough to say or no when you're on this. Because I would really love to get into some of these other chapters go out and look at the book. I think probably the homework assignment for the members of Trail Runner Nation is go buy the book, so the next time you can already have read it and be up to speed.
And if any of the members have any questions, they could always email us or Facebook us with some questions, and we could bring it on the next time.
Yeah, we'll do a little chin wagging.
Yeah, we could do a call in or whatever.
Oh, that would be good. Some live chin wags. All right.
Yeah. Live chin wagging. Hey, so you got you. Right. Live chimp wagging and live chimp stroking. It's perfect.
We need to edit that. Some of the you know.
We'll just have to put it. We'll just have to move our ratings from general to explicit.
Yeah. So you guys are in Colorado right now. You have a big.
Yes.
Both of you are competing this weekend. Yeah. Is that right?
No, it's just me.
She marginalizes my effort. Did you notice that? Yeah, I'm doing a trail race Sunday, a running race, but the real championship pro race is the Saturday. Whatever, that's what I say.
That's right.
All I'm saying is Si's job this afternoon is to clean my bike.
Can you believe that?
Oh, well, at least he has a purpose.
That's right. Yeah, I do. Yeah, so
well,
we're here
luck
for Xterra,
good luck at your
Creek. It's an off-road triathlon, and then there's a good Xterra Trail Series as well that on the following day, every time there's a race, it's great fun. Good group of people.
Fantastic. Well, you have a great race, both of you. They're equally important to each one of you. And the brave athlete, calm the F down and rise to the occasion, Simon Marshall, PhD, and Leslie Patterson, professional athlete, have really put together a nice book here. And we appreciate getting to spend a few moments with you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Right, thanks,
it's been
guys.
Great. It's a pleasure.
So go out and run.
Mas.
Another sister shooting hair on Damaris. Amputees and free time Sierra Leone's. The church walking on us. The state put the youth in a harness. Creating hostility among us. The teacher said no college. Still kid gotta get a check with a couple commas. People wanna bomb us. More people gotta scatter and run from us. Blame it on Zeus and Apollo and Adonis. But what you've done here is put yourself between a bullet and a target. And it won't be long before you're pulling yourself away. But what you've done here is put yourself between a bullet and a target. And it won't be long before you're pulling yourself away.
She drink a beer with